One thing that people might be surprised to learn is that CPI is a basket of goods that's just kind of cherry-picked. They don't actually measure rent. They ask homeowners, what would you rent your place for? And they call that owner's equivalent rent. And that's the measure that they use for changes in rent. You're almost creating like a boomer question.
Yes.
People whose perspective is way cheaper prices for rent from when they actually rented. Like so many people, I just dismissed it. I thought there's no way that this could actually solve any problems. I wish I could go back in time and kick myself. You could literally be working January through April. All of that goes to the government. And then whatever you make starting in May is actually going to go in your pocket. That's crazy. I mean, you're basically like a debt slave. And it's really sad.
People have told me because they heard I'm doing a podcast and they're like, well, I have some XRP. What do you tell people?
Well, some of these tokens have very good marketing teams, right? They're centralized. I've met so many people too. I mean, yesterday I got my nails done last night and the woman said the same thing because she knows I do a Bitcoin show. And she said, I had it and then I sold it. I'm like, it's not too late to get back in. And I think it's just kind of reminding people again where this is all going and how big the opportunity really is. Obviously, Bitcoin is the best asset. And so I hope that people start to realize that more and more.
Everyone, welcome back. I have Natalie Brunell here with me today. She's the host of Coin Stories, and she's a Bitcoin educator and a financial media commentator. So I just want to let you know that you're an inspiration for me to start my own podcast so that I can talk to more Bitcoiners and hear about their journey. Because I've been into Bitcoin since 2020 and I love your show and I've been listening to it for years and I love all the Bitcoin talk, but I just feel for people who don't understand Bitcoin, it's nice to have a podcast where you could reach more people that isn't just about the technical stuff or the number go up stuff. So it could be a way to, you know, to just have a larger audience. So I love that you do that with your show. So I just wanted to tell you that.
Oh, well, thank you so much. That means so much to me. I really appreciate it.
Yeah. And I wanted to also tell you about how we have some things in common. We have parents that came from another country and, you know, your parents are Polish, you're Polish. And my parents came from Greece. And I heard your interview one day, I think it was with Efrat. And I loved that interview because I heard more about your history and your journey. And it's something that I want you to talk about a little bit more today, because I think that the way that you grow up and your parents come to America and search for a better life for their kids, and it's the whole American dream. And just to hear about what you saw growing up and how that impacted you?
Yeah, absolutely. It's crazy that so many people I meet in Bitcoin have sort of an immigration story or kind of a pain point from the past that led them to ultimately appreciating Bitcoin. And for me, it was definitely the fact that I saw my parents work so hard trying to achieve the American dream. I came to the US with them when I was 5 years old. And then my childhood memory is just literally watching them work nonstop, 6 days a week. My dad would get up at 3 o'clock in the morning. And I thought people were wealthy if they had a garage, because I could literally see from my window. Sometimes, you know, you would get up if you hear your parents early in the morning, and I would look out my window and he would be scraping the car from the frost and the snow because we were outside Chicago. And it planted a seed and motivated me, because I was like, I see what life could be like here. I see these beautiful homes with the white picket fences, kids that grew up very differently in nice houses. And I wanted to achieve success and justify the sacrifice that they made coming here. So it definitely made me a very ambitious person. They instilled the idea that I have to work hard at school. I was in one of those families where it was pretty much unacceptable to get a B. Like, you had to get A's and focus on schoolwork. And so I worked really hard, really grateful for that. You know, sometimes when you're a kid, you're like, why are you guys so strict? But in the end, it did really pay off. And what's crazy is when I got to college, the great financial crisis happened. So it was transformative for me, because I grew up with a lot of hope that with all the hard work that I saw my parents do and that I was doing in school, that you can achieve success and you can climb the ladder and have financial security. And all of a sudden, my family was left bankrupt. My family lost their house. And I graduated right into that recession with basically job offers that paid me less than high school internships. And I'm like, what is going on in this system? And of course, you see the headlines because I was studying journalism and all the bankers get bailed out and all the rich people are fine. But the average working family is really struggling more than ever. I think that caused me to be very motivated to expose corruption. I pursued investigative journalism and I wanted to hold the powerful accountable. I would be the reporter that was always chasing the politician. They never liked me coming around. I was so ignorant to the fact that I didn't understand the financial system. So I did like so many people, and a lot of people in my audience were once like this, where it's like you hear, well, these wealthy people are making an exorbitant amount. They pay no taxes. Just tax the rich and redistribute it. You know, we can fix it with the right politician. And I realized you can't fix it if the money's broken. And no matter who you put in office, they're going to keep expanding the debt and keep expanding the supply, which dilutes the value of every dollar. And so what fixes that? And I finally came to the conclusion that it was Bitcoin, but wish I discovered it sooner.
Yeah, I know, like we all do. And I love that that's why the dress that you wore to combat AOC's dress was iconic. I love that you came back with that, fix the money instead of tax the rich. That was incredible. And that's the truth. You know, you don't fix it by taxing, you know, the rich people, because you just continue to allow this money theft to continue. So it's not the way to go. You have to actually start at the root cause of the problem. So I love that you were in college when that happened. And then you decided, when you saw the great financial crisis, that you decided to take that turn and expose corruption. And that's what gave you the fire to do that. Because when you keep uncovering truths and then you start to realize, you know, where is this money coming from and why, that actually leads you eventually to Bitcoin. So what year was it when you actually got started working with Bitcoin and you left your career? Investigative journalism is a thing of the past now. You just focus on Bitcoin?
Yes. My focus is 100% on my show and content that is educational and also newsworthy. So I've sort of combined my background with Bitcoin, but I didn't discover it until 2017. I was working as a news reporter in California's state capitol. And if anyone follows California, it's got a lot of issues with corruption, financial problems, all of that. It was a great place to be a reporter, but I had friends that were living in San Francisco, because Sacramento is a very small town. A lot of people go to San Francisco for weekends. So my friends were in San Francisco and they were all talking about Bitcoin and Coinbase. And that was the previous bull run, the 2017 one, where I think Bitcoin went from like a couple hundred to eventually 20,000 and then crashed back down. But when I first heard about it, it was around $3,000. Like so many people, I just dismissed it. I thought there's no way that this could actually solve any problems. It's probably, if I put my money in it, I'm probably going to lose it. But at the same time, when you're working in news, like so many people in other industries as well, you aren't making enough to get by. You're spending a huge chunk of your take-home pay on rent. And you're always you feel like you're sort of on a treadmill that's getting faster and faster. I think a part of me, because I was always a saver and because I felt frustrated financially, I was like, well, what if this is a lotto ticket that pays off? Like, I should probably put something in this. So that's when I first made purchases. And of course, I didn't know the differences between Bitcoin and crypto. So I bought Bitcoin, Ethereum, I think XRP at the time. So I didn't understand, right? And then it took me a couple years before I actually went down the rabbit hole, because I had a mentor of mine that was encouraging me to read the Bitcoin Standard. I wish I could go back in time and kick myself, because when I first looked at the book title and cover, I was like, I don't want to read a book about computer science or computer programming. I'm way too busy. This isn't my forte or my area of interest. So I pushed it aside thinking that it was like a computer science book or technology. Obviously it is, but it's so much more than that. And the book itself is like 99% about the history of money. When I finally picked it up, thank goodness, it was a transformative moment for me. I remember throughout the book, just texting my mentor being like, oh my gosh, how did I not know this before? This is why we have all these problems. Oh my, like now maybe we can fix it. Oh my gosh, could Bitcoin actually really work? Now that takes you down the rabbit hole and you eventually learn more and then your conviction grows. So your portfolio grows. And I haven't looked back since I left my job in 2021. I'm so grateful that I've been able to create a career in Bitcoin.
Yeah, that's incredible. It's such a fast journey when you think about it. It just kind of feels like, you know, it's super crazy where you think where you came from and how quickly things turned around. But I just remember too, like, that book, the Bitcoin Standard, is literally the book that you tell everybody to read first when they should understand Bitcoin. And I gave it to one of my friends who actually just started, you know, wanting to buy Bitcoin. So he borrowed it when we went to the Bitcoin conference this year. And I ended up meeting the author, Saif Dean, over there. And I was looking through my bag to get my book out so he could sign it. I didn't have it because I gave it to my friend. So I turned around and bought the Fiat Standard, his second book, and I'm here, and he signed that one. So I was so happy. But yeah, he's, you know, hearing him speak is incredible. And, you know, he has taught so many, you know, about the truth of the history of money. And that's one thing that, you know, when people see the title, they sometimes just get deterred. But that's what I like about Lawrence Lepard's book, The Big Print, is it kind of is sort of like would maybe speak to someone like you where you want to find out truth and it looks like the dollar ripping on the cover and it doesn't say it's about Bitcoin, obviously, in your face. So it would kind of get maybe some more people into it that don't see the word Bitcoin and think it's about computers or think it's about something that they don't want to take the time to learn. So I love that that was your journey. And I love that you saw what was happening with your family and you see your parents working hard. And that's where I came from. That's where, you know, my parents worked hard all their life. And, you know, for a long time, it seemed like it was good, you know, but my parents didn't know anything about investing. And I started to wonder when I got into Bitcoin, you know, all the people that have wealth are people that have invested money in the stock market. You know, my parents saved money their whole life and it was working, working, working. But then it starts to feel like it's not working after a while and things just get more expensive and you're working harder or the same and you're getting, you know, less for it. So it just really starts to scare you. And you think that, you know, trying to figure out a way to preserve that, that's just, and for me, it was just finding out about the truth, you know, finding out about money printing. And that happened for me in 2020 when I started to realize the amount of money that was being printed. So, and then just, you know, starting this podcast has been incredible. It's been since February, but I love talking to people like you. I love talking to any Bitcoiner and just hearing about what brought them to it because somebody could resonate with you. So it's super important to hear how that all got started. And you're writing your own book, which I'm super excited about too. It's, coming out this November, and it's called Bitcoin is for Everyone. So what inspired you to write a book?
Yeah, thank you so much. Well, first of all, I just feel like I'm listening to the story of my own parents when I hear about yours, because it was the same situation in my household. My parents told me to save, but they thought that the stock market was for wealthy people and they saw it as way too risky and for people in a totally different class than them. And so they saved in basically cash. At the time, you know, in the 90s, we did have higher interest rates on basic accounts, but not amazing, probably not outpacing inflation. And the one thing that they would invest in is gold, probably because of their kind of communist roots and that being a form of hard money back in Poland. But yeah, they fell behind very, very quickly because the people that really did well, especially in the 90s and 2000s, they were investing in real estate and stocks. And so my parents, their cash was sort of that melting ice cube that I didn't understand until I learned about Bitcoin. As for the book, first of all, I love all the books out there. I have just been gobbling up every single Bitcoin book since I got into the space. I've read Bitcoin Standard probably 3 times. I've read all of Saif Dean's books that came out after that. I loved Lynn Alden's Broken Money. I loved Larry's book. Price of Tomorrow is also fantastic by Jeff Booth. There are so many great books out there. But when someone approached me asking if I thought about writing a book, I thought the more, like, no book detracts from another. I think everything is accretive. And if my book can reach someone, maybe because they pick it up and they see that it's a woman who's the author or a person who had no finance background or someone that came to it from the background of being an immigrant and watching her parents struggle and losing everything in the great financial crisis. I just think everyone has a voice and a story. And so I wanted to share a very, very approachable, gentle orange pill and just share what I wish I would have known very, very early on. So I sort of like took from as inspiration from all the different books that I've read and the different content that I've absorbed over the years and combined it into what I wish I had back in 2017. And And I'm so grateful for all the other authors out there that have helped me along the way. And so I just hope to be another piece, you know, another book on the shelf that will hopefully help someone. And I'm so excited for it to come out in November because it's been almost like a 2-year process at this point and put a lot of love and passion into it.
That's great. That's so amazing that you take everything that you know that helped you along your journey and you take those key moments or those parts that really stuck with you and, you know, you build from there and you also having that voice as a woman, it does reach more people. Because a lot of people just don't, I mean, mainly a lot of Bitcoiners are men, you know, so it's nice to hear more female Bitcoin podcasts, you know, from a woman's standpoint or somebody, yes, who has no financial actual background. It's nice to hear, you know, how you discovered what the truth about money is. And you don't have to be, you know, having a master's in finance or something like that. So I can't wait to read your book. I'm so excited. And it's just the thing about going back to our parents too, and about what they thought about the stock market and investing. It was just how you thought when you first got Bitcoin, you thought you didn't understand it yet, but you just got it because you thought it was like that lottery ticket. A lot of people think when they get into the stock market too, if they don't get into, you know, the Magnificent Seven and hold for 20 years or more, they just think that they hear about this stock, it's going to go up. It's like a lottery ticket. They're just buying a stock thinking that they're going to get rich off of something if it hits. Cause you know, there have been stories like that. And I think that, you know, Bitcoin isn't a lottery ticket once you realize it, once you understand. But when you first get into it, you kind of do think of it that way. You think that maybe this will be something. And just like Satoshi said, you know, you might as well get some in case it catches on. So you did that. But I think once you actually understand it, it's literally the truth. It's actually based on something, you know, it's actually value transfer that can be based on actual protection for the fact that no one can change the rules of the game and no one can steal from it. So, you know, thinking of it as this shield for whatever work you've put in is a great way to think about it, but yeah. It's literally not, you know, nothing like a stock market. It's totally different. So it's just,
yeah.
When you go down that rabbit hole, you find out all these things that you realize why it's so important.
Yeah. Well, what I think is similar with Bitcoin to investing in stocks is that you kind of always think you're too late, right? You look at the chart and you're like, well, I wish I had Amazon at that starting point, a few cents or dollars. And you look at it and you always feel like you're coming in at the wrong time. Mm-hmm. But look at what the stock market has done over the past few decades. That has been an enormous engine for wealth. And people thought they were late getting Apple, you know, a couple years ago or before the pandemic, and look at where it is now. And so I urge people to have the same mentality when they're looking at Bitcoin, because yes, these prices can probably feel so out of reach for a lot of the average people. And a huge part of that is because people don't understand Satoshis and the unit bias that we have in Bitcoin, but yet it's so early because people don't have that frame of reference. If they're just working hard in some other industry other than finance, that the world is made up of all of this wealth and it's divided in these asset classes, and a ton of it is in stocks and a ton of it's in bonds and real estate. Bitcoin sits there, just this tiny little $2 trillion market cap. And so if it just, you know, 10x's from here, it's still going to be tiny. And if it does another 10x, it's going to be still relatively small. So there's a huge amount of growth potential. And I see it as a massive opportunity, especially for young people and people that are trying to catch up when they've felt left behind for many years.
Yeah. And it's a huge amount of growth potential combined with the fact that there is a limited supply available. So you have all this room for growth with such a limited amount of it. So that's just something that you have to remember. But what do you say to people? What do you say to people who I hear a lot that they bought Bitcoin and they sold it back in whatever year it was, you know, they sold it because they didn't realize what they had and they just needed the money at the time. But what do you say to people who do that and then they still didn't get back into it at this time? And then they say, I've heard literally in the last week, I think 3 people have told me this because they heard I'm doing a podcast and they're like, well, I have some XRP. And I'm just like, well, Bitcoin is different. You know, what do you kind of tell people that it's not too late for them? You know, that they shouldn't be discouraged, you know, because they sold at some point.
Well, some of these tokens have very good marketing teams, right? They're centralized and they also just appear cheaper. And I think that's what's confusing a lot of people. Because again, to that point that you look at Bitcoin's price and you're like, well, I cannot get in at this point. And mm-hmm. I've met so many people too. I mean, yesterday I got my nails done last night and the woman said the same thing because she knows I do a Bitcoin show and she said, I had it and then I sold it. I'm like, it's not too late to get back in. And I think it's just kind of reminding people again where this is all going and how big the opportunity really is and how it can eat into these other asset classes and start to take some of that wealth and liquidity and shift it into this new asset class. I think also as soon as we get more sort of legitimization and institutionalization that encourages passive flows, it will really help Bitcoin because a lot of people do have their money tied up with either wealth advisors or in their 401k and they can't or don't know how to tap into it or no one's recommending it to them. Like mm-hmm. I had one of the top RIAs in America on my show recently, Rick Edelman, and he used to be a very big Bitcoin skeptic. He was anti-Bitcoin. Now he's recommending up to 40% in your portfolio and he's recommending it to all the RIAs. And one thing he said is that the wheels of that industry just turn so slow because you have to get so many approvals. You have to get outside consultants to approve it. You have to have board approval. The board meets only four times a year. So it's just like a slow grind. But once those floodgates open, they manage trillions and trillions of dollars worth of wealth. And so even if a little bit of that goes into Bitcoin, that's a significant windfall for Bitcoin in terms of the demand versus the small supply. So I think it's coming. The one thing I am curious about and wonder about as a content creator is in 2021, the attention on Bitcoin and 2020, when the money printer was going crazy and we were hitting all-time highs and everyone was at home and they had time probably, right, to consume the content, it was just like something I had never experienced. And I was a part of it. I was consuming as well. But just the amount of attention, interest, searches, text messages, like, how do I get Bitcoin? We have not gotten back to that yet.
Don't forget to subscribe to my channel and check out these awesome products. Make sure you check out the Bitcoin Advisor. You don't have to choose between self-custody and peace of mind. Also, don't forget to check out Satoshi's. This isn't just fashion, it's signal. Wear the message and plant the idea. Use my link below for 10% off your order.
Yeah. And so my question is, when will that happen? Because with Bitcoin growing and so many people predicting that it will be a significant asset class for not just individual investors, but also these institutions and at a government level, when will that mainstream hockey stick up happen again, where everyone is finally embracing Bitcoin in a way that I don't think we've seen in years? And that I don't know when that's going to happen or what's going to spark it.
And I think that some of it is because people, you know, it goes back to, you know, media and how sometimes you have a narrative stuck in your head. And I just think about when everybody was getting into crypto and retail investing was high, a lot of people heard about FTX, mm-hmm. you know, so a lot of people, when you talk to people about Bitcoin, they think, oh, was that Sam Bankman-Fried guy? Or was that FTX mm-hmm. thing? Because they saw all the commercials and the ads and Larry David and all these things were in mm-hmm. your face about it. And then yeah. it collapsed and it was all over the news and everyone's like, you know, yeah. crypto, Bitcoin. So they correlate these two things in their mind. And when they think about it, it was like that mania phase where people yeah. actually were like, we're all going to get into this. But then now they remember the main media narrative that was this thing collapsed, you know, yeah. this went bad, but Bitcoin never got hacked. Bitcoin never had a problem. It was the exchange, you know, so people yeah. don't know the difference. And I think that's why I think a lot of people were infected with this mm-hmm. whole, you know, idea of what Bitcoin is.
Yeah, it's crazy because every group that is resistant to Bitcoin is against it for a different reason. And they're so passionate about that reason. I found on the institutional TradFi level, there's no cash flows. With like the retail audience, FTX, oh my God, it's scary. I could lose all my money. With people on left-wing politics, it's the energy component. It's going to boil the oceans. The right wingers, they say the government's going to step in and ban it because they're not going to want a competing currency and it threatens the dollar. Mm-hmm. I mean, literally there's all these groups and pockets and they each stick to a reason that they are not going to invest in Bitcoin. And I just think it takes time, right? For any of us. I think that as long as you're open-minded and you take some time to learn about it, mm-hmm. then Bitcoin changes all of us, but well, so many people, they latch on to that one argument and then they can't get past it. I mean, Tucker Carlson is a perfect example. He has such an issue with it not having a founder that we can pinpoint, identify, that it could have been created by the state or as a tool of one of these agencies that he shines a spotlight and, you know, tries to expose through a show. And even if it was, which I don't think it was, it doesn't matter, right? It's completely decentralized. So it just, there are so many pockets of resistance and you just got to continue the education and work your way through them. And eventually most people see the light and see Bitcoin.
Yeah, because I think that when people echo these thoughts, you know, they're echoing that party or that, you know, whatever group that they're echoing, you're echoing a whole set of people that you have, that you're not thinking for yourself. If you go and read the book on your own, you would do your own research and you would actually learn about it yourself and see, form your own opinion about it when you actually do the work. But if you're just saying the typical things that people say in these groups, you're literally an echo of these thoughts. You're not having your own idea. So you should, if you want to form an opinion, you have to at least understand what it is to form your own opinion. So people are just doing that. They just need to like, don't sound like everybody else in that particular group. Yeah. You just sound like an NPC or something.
Just the amount of resistance.
Yeah. The amount of resistance is just, it's just going to be something that, I don't know. I just keep thinking it's going to be something we haven't seen before. Cause now I even heard Jack Mallers talking today about how the new possible Treasury Secretary is talking about the Fed and how they're going after, you know, Jerome Powell for these renovations that he spent billions of dollars on, and how they're talking about, you know, this CBDC Genius Act and how, you know, it's going to bring trillions of dollars into, you know, the cryptocurrency market, which would, you know, infiltrate Bitcoin, and it would all be the same thing. I feel like it's going to happen very soon. So I think for people that haven't yet done the work, it's a great time to do it because things are happening that haven't happened before. And, you know, get out of that narrative that you have in your mind and actually learn about it. Because the time is, I think, coming like very soon. Yeah.
Well, it's funny because when I am within Bitcoin Twitter, I mean, we all get it and we reinforce it. And if I make a point on a show or I have a piece of content, it's just so well received. But it's been really interesting because one of my goals is to get outside of our sort of bubble and speak to people who are talking about other topics and trying to help them understand Bitcoin. And some of them are starting to get interested, but it's few and far between. But the comments, if I do a video on, say, a channel where it's not a Bitcoin audience, it tells you immediately how early we are. Oh, wow. I mean, if I go on a Bitcoin show, every and I look at the comments because I'm genuinely curious, like, where are people's minds at?
Yeah.
Sometimes I shouldn't read the comments. But I'm genuinely curious because I always want to improve my work and, you know, what questions people have. And if I go on a Bitcoin show, it's all good. I went on like a German news show. My gosh, I got blasted for even some of the books I had behind me on my shelf that were just about capitalism. I mean, blasted in the comments. And I did a show with Dinesh D'Souza and he's got a 5 million people audience on Twitter and just so many anti-Bitcoin comments. And I'm like, wow, we are so early. Well, and sometimes we don't realize it because within the Bitcoin X or Twitter world, we think everyone feels the way we do. And no, we are very early.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. That is so funny. And I think that's why sometimes when that whole No Kings protest was going on, I do realize that X is so pro Bitcoin. But when there's other platforms, they don't see the same thing. So I kept seeing this movement happening across the world. Everyone's calling for No Kings. And I'm like, well, Bitcoin is the true No Kings movement because you don't have a ruler. You don't have someone to control the, you know, how much there is or change the rules in the game or anything like that. So I started to actually post, not specifically about Bitcoin, but I was going on Threads, you know, because I heard about this new thing called Threads and I didn't have it. So I'm like, I'm going to download Threads and I'm going to go start commenting on all these people's No Kings protests. But then I would sometime at the end put Bitcoin is the true No Kings protest. And I was like trying to just plant a seed somewhere, you know, like they're close. They're fighting against something that they think is this great cause, but there's a root cause, you know, and that's the true, you know, reason. And that's the truth, you know, it's like a base layer of a lot of the problems in the world. So I'm like thinking people are having this uprising against this corruption and, you know, what's happening, but I'm like, you're almost there. I'm like, I'm trying to get outside my box too, and trying to like plant a seed or like a YouTube video and be like, maybe somebody will see it, you know, but yeah, X is heavily pro Bitcoin and we're so used to everyone just, yes, we understand, you know, but it is kind of fun to try to get your, you know, opinion out there, at least if everyone else is sharing their opinions, why not comment, you know, something and actually just have our voices out there, even if it's a comment in a video, to kind of go back and just, so it's not all against, you know. And even when it comes to the idea or the argument that it was created by the government, if it was, which again, who cares if it was, but I think the funny thing about that is that people are under this impression that if everyone gets Bitcoin and the government created it, then they're going to know everything you do with your money. They already know everything you do with your money. Everyone spends on credit and debit. Who spends with cash very much besides me, because I work with cash at my salon a lot of times, but most of the time people direct deposit everything. Everyone knows where their money goes. But if anyone was to be scared that we would know where the money is going, it should be the government. The government should be like, now we have a ledger and we know exactly what money is going where. So now we know who sent money. You know, it'll be more for them to be held accountable, not us. We already, you know, are being tracked for the most part. So it's kind of like a gaslighting thing in a way, where it's regular people think that they should be scared that they'll know about where we spend our money, but it's actually a tool for us to keep them accountable. So.
Yeah. And kind of to my earlier point, where I was also in the mindset of we should tax the rich, people are really distracted by politics today because the populism has grown to a point where people are frustrated and they know that there needs to be change, but we can't agree on that change. And a lot of the symptoms of the core problem of broken money, I think they're getting muddied up in people's brains, which is, again, understandable. Because if you don't understand that the root cause of a lot of this corruption is money and how a few people make it, and then the people closest to them benefit at the expense of everyone else, you're gonna try to point to these political things. And then we get into these social debates that personally, I don't think we will ever solve. I think that if we tackle the economic issue, then a lot of the other symptoms will actually calm down, because it's almost like we're attacking the cancer cells and then the patient can start to heal and we can become a little bit more cooperative and have more constructive debates about some of the other topics that maybe we disagree on. But like the financial aspect is, I think, the area where us Bitcoiners, we can do a lot of good and we can be super productive, because it's something we can all agree on and get on the same page, right? I mean, there are so many things that we vote on politically that I think we will still be debating about 100 years from now. Mm-hmm. But if we could get the money right, I think that that will improve most people's quality of life by a massive amount, like a magnitudes more than we have, especially for young people. And then we can, you know, people who then become wealthy from Bitcoin can use that money to pay for advocacy about other topics that they're really interested in. But I think the first thing we need to tackle is the money.
Yeah. And that's why your book is so important too, just calling it Bitcoin is for Everyone, because for all those people that want to, you know, say something in comments when you join a different type of show and give their argument about why they think Bitcoin isn't something good for them or for the world. Like, you have blinders on when you think of it that way, because you're thinking of it as an American possibly that's watching this show. You're not thinking of it as somebody from a different country who the dollar has destroyed their currency. You're not thinking about it for people who are being literally like Venezuela, I think, where you have to take a wheelbarrow full of cash to go buy some groceries. It's literally, who's going to count that? It's just on the streets. Mm-hmm. But it's happening like a domino effect, one country after the other. The more, because of our dollar being the global reserve currency, it affects other countries. So people need Bitcoin more in other countries than maybe the people in America do. Yeah. So those people are adopting it, whether you like it or not. So if you think that Bitcoin isn't the cure because you're looking at it from an American political standpoint, the rest of the world doesn't care, because they need a safety. You know, they need Bitcoin because they have, this is their last resort and it's working, you know? So it's a terrible argument for people who are stuck in a bubble.
Yeah, for sure. I think this is one of the really good things about stablecoins being able to grow and proliferate, because internationally they've been such a lifeline. So many currencies are far, far worse than the dollar. The dollar is like the cleanest of all the dirty socks, but it's still very dirty. And for people in countries where their currency is literally collapsing, I think digital dollars is just going to be a great escape valve and allows them to find Bitcoin easier and start saving in Bitcoin. But I do think the whole stablecoin development is really interesting because at the heart of it, it's not just about innovation, and it's certainly not about Congress coming together to vote for, you know, the international lifeline for people in other countries, but it's more so about strategically extending dollar dominance and finding more buyers for our debt. Tether holds, I think it's trillions now in U.S. securities and U.S. treasuries, and now these stablecoin issuers will be mandated to back the stablecoins with cash and short-term treasuries, and that's very good for a nation that wants to keep going into debt and can't find as many foreign buyers. So I just wonder how this is all going to play out over the coming years, because I do think a lot of people, again, they're not going to want to save in their fiat currency in some random country where it's collapsing against the dollar. They're going to want to flee to the dollar, mm-hmm. but then the people with the dollar is also collapsing against Bitcoin. So hopefully it encourages more of that adoption and people see Bitcoin as that life raft and as that savings technology. And I think that the US will embrace it. And maybe in a couple years or in a decade, we will have a US dollar that's largely backed by not just our debt, but also by a strategic Bitcoin reserve. I think that that's very realistic to expect.
Yes. And that's why I think that you saying that reminds me of, it's a bridge, and why the name Tether is the perfect name, because it tethers the system so that all of these dollars can flood into this digital dollar space. And then when people start seeing that their digital dollars aren't still growing as fast as Bitcoin is, you're able to move your money over a lot easier. It's something that is going to be super interesting to see how it all plays out.
Right. Like, I agree with what Michael Saylor has said, which is that we do really need to modernize the financial rails of this entire system and bring them to the 21st century. Because the fact that, for example, you can't trade things outside of banking hours, you can't do anything on a weekend except for with things like Bitcoin, the technology is there to empower it. And so we're taking that one next step closer, and stablecoins are definitely going to be a part of that. But I think in the coming years, everything's just going to be within a fingertip on your phone, being able to access different tokens that represent stocks, and things will be 24/7 and global. And there's a lot of empowerment in that. But obviously, Bitcoin is the best asset, and it is the best form of capital, and it is what you want to build your business on. It's what you're going to want to have your family savings in. And so I hope that people start to realize that more and more.
Mm-hmm. Yes. About people realizing that, I'm thinking about Peter Schiff again, and about how you do such a great job. And hearing you speak to him at the Bitcoin conference, you do such a great job talking to him because you're so gracious with him, but you put him in his place, but you also keep it light. Like, you're kind of funny. You're not aggressive to the point where, okay, this is uncomfortable. You have a perfect balance handling people like that, but it was really entertaining to hear you talk to him. The way I think of him, like a Bitcoin internet troll in a way. He just loves it. He just thinks it's so much fun. So I just don't understand how he doesn't get it at this point. That's what I think is so baffling. How do you deal with that?
You know, I think that he's become such a character in the Bitcoin space. He's the ultimate Bitcoin villain, and he's probably been able to monetize on that. But I think that on any given day, if he were to suddenly tweet, you know what, I was wrong, and now I'm a Bitcoiner, most Bitcoiners would welcome him with a wide embrace and be super excited. So it's just, he's turned into a bit of a meme, and it's entertaining. I guess one of the reasons why I interact with him the way that I do is because I think that he's so smart about the problem, like the macro side. And I've listened to not only his show, but I've read his book, The Real Crash. Mm-hmm. And that book actually really stuck with me. I included in my list of must reads when someone's learning about Bitcoin, because even though it has nothing to do with Bitcoin, it talks about what happened with our money, why it's so corrupted and broken. And he actually kind of breaks down every agency within government and how he would change it make it so that people had more freedom. And his dad was really, I don't know if a lot of people know this, but if you watch my coin story with him, like my original one, which was back in 2021 summer, I went back to the beginning and I learned this incredible story about his father. And his father went to prison fighting for his constitutional rights, that he said income tax it's not legal. And he went, literally took it to the furthest extreme he could take it, and he was put in prison for it. And so Peter and his dad, they are like constitutional aficionados. It's fascinating to hear them talk because they can pull out specific articles, specific sections just from memory. Like he knows everything about how money was actually defined by the Constitution. And so I feel like his story and his journey is influenced a lot by seeing what his dad went through and wanting to do something right about it. And so it's sad that he resists Bitcoin because it's like the ultimate solution and fix. And I think that he has a good heart and I think he'll eventually come around to it and it'll be kind of entertaining. Where I reserve my, you know, my more of an aggressive tone is for corrupt politicians. I mean, I was always that reporter where if you were potentially doing something corrupt, you would not want me around because I was not going to let you off gently. And I chased them and I got door slammed in my face. And a lot of people don't even believe that because I'm definitely more of like an, you know, happy-go-lucky person and podcaster. I do not stand for corruption. I just don't. If you have stolen from people, if you are doing something that you know is wrong, I want all of those people to be held accountable. I do. It makes me mad because I think about my parents and how good they were, how they played by all the rules, how kind they were to everyone around them. And they get screwed over by these types of people, right? And so that's who I reserve that for, but not Peter Schiff. He just doesn't understand Bitcoin clearly.
Well, he probably just has that standpoint where he wrote this book and he has that history with his dad and he has this, you know, the gold securities and he has all this stuff that he's looked at as a, you know, somebody who is standing for the truth and somebody who doesn't want to be swayed by something that isn't, he wants to be a leader for people. So he thinks that maybe if he were to advocate for Bitcoin, then if something were to happen and it wasn't the right decision, then he'll be looked at like that kind of a person. So maybe he just doesn't because he has to be this figure for his history and all the work he's done uncovering these things. He doesn't want to be like, I overlooked something that maybe something happened with Bitcoin. I didn't see it, you know, and I pretty much brought people down with me because I decided to, you know, but even though I think the more we study, the less we can find a reason that that would ever happen, which I think that it would be nice if you could see that. But it's nice that you also did that research and found out about his history, because it is sad that his father went to prison for that, because I believe the same thing that, you know, taxes, property taxes, all of it. Why do we pay? I mean, people think, oh, it helps pay for the roads and pays for schools and all this stuff.
Yeah.
All the money that they get is just a fraction of what's actually being spent. Like everything is printing. And even Bukele said it. He said that why do Americans pay taxes when your government has the ability to print money and they print in the trillions? I just think it's unjust, especially with the fact that because they're printing this money, it's making life harder for other people. And it's, I just wonder, would that ever change? I don't know if you ever think it would.
Yeah. I mean, I definitely have developed some more opinions about all these taxes, and it's hard because of course the government wants revenue, but I really do think that taxes, they stifle growth as opposed to encouraging it, right? I mean, why would you want to do something productive, take on all the risk and spend all this time when half of it is literally going to be taken from you by the government? And that's what I thought was crazy, because in California, when I was living there, I mean, depending on what income bracket you're in, you could literally be working January through April. All of that goes to the government. And then whatever you make starting in May is actually going to go in your pocket. I mean, that's how you can start to think about it. Because if they're taking 40% basically of what you earn or more, that's crazy. I mean, you're basically like a debt slave, and it's really sad. So, I mean, I'm not a constitutional expert. I wish I was to be able to articulate some of these opinions in a way that would hold up in court. but I do think it's crazy that when a lot of these taxes started, they were so much smaller, and like they inch up incrementally little by little because none of these governments are responsible with their finances. And all of a sudden you zoom out and it's like our founding fathers would have never allowed for these types of taxes, right? Yeah. I mean, people are literally giving up a massive chunk of their income every single year, and you're basically taxed on the home that you live in if you own it, as if you're renting it from the government. It's so crazy. Mm-hmm. And I wish we could change those things. I don't know.
I wonder if it would, because if you think about it that way, that 40% of your income is being taxed, but also 40% of the money supply has been created in the last how many years? Probably since 2020. Mm-hmm. maybe before that, but it's a short amount of time that much more money has been added to the system. Yes. And you're still paying 40% taxes. So all that money that was added to the system contributes to higher prices for you.
Yeah.
And you're still not getting a break on taxes. It would be nice if eventually there was some solution to that, because it's how much harder can things get for people? I mean, there's a breaking point, and who's going to help fix that? Because the more pain that people experience, the more they look for an answer.
Yeah, this is actually sort of the meat of the beginning of my book, Bitcoin is for Everyone. Because I, even as a reporter, one thing that I always thought was strange was when Thanksgiving and Christmas would come around, those are the big shopping seasons, right? Mm-hmm. We would measure the health of the economy by how much people were spending and not saving. And we must have been given the numbers of, we must have been reporting the CPI, but I truly never paid attention to CPI until Bitcoin taught me to question it. And until, you know, we were starting to tick up and it made headlines everywhere because of the pandemic and all of the money printing. Inflation was not a word or concept I ever thought about. And I certainly never connected it to the money supply and ask the fundamental questions of, well, wait a second. They say inflation is 2%, but my bills have gone up like 10, sometimes 50, sometimes 100%. Why is that not reflected in the inflation number? And oh, by the way, they're literally diluting the supply, printing more units at a rate of like 7% a year. And I'm never getting a 7% raise. And I feel like if just that message alone starts to get out to the public more, where they're like, well, wait a second. Okay, yeah, maybe they've told me that inflation has cooled down, but my premium's up 100%. My groceries are up 40%. The math doesn't work. What's right. happening here? Yeah. Why has a lot of that money actually gone to things like stocks and real estate, and who owns those? And why is there this disproportionate, you know, wealth effect that's created? I think if more people understood that, they would go, oh, this is a problem.
Right.
What is a potential solution? And, you know, my book obviously says it's Bitcoin.
Yeah, that's great. And also the CPI, isn't that where they used to include certain things in those numbers and the data? And then they started to remove things like housing and food and energy. So they really just decide what things get included in that data.
Yes.
So that it makes their numbers look better.
Yeah. So I include a little chunk about this in my book too. One thing that people might be surprised to learn is that CPI is a basket of goods that's kind of cherry picked is what you learn. And it's also rearranged. And before 2002, it was rearranged every 10 years. After 2002, it was rearranged every 2 years. Wow. And after 2022, it's now rearranged every single year. And so, yes, they will substitute things like steak for chicken and they'll call it the same because, oh, wait, more people are probably buying chicken. If there's like a new safety feature or technology feature in a car, they will not count that as a more expensive vehicle. The crazy thing is rent is a massive portion of so many people's, you know, expenses, especially for young people. It certainly was for me. Sometimes I was paying 50% of my paycheck just on rent because I was in big cities. And they don't actually measure rent. They ask homeowners, what would you rent your place for? And they call that owner's equivalent rent. And that's the measure that they use for changes in rent. And what I think is funny about that is if you've owned your house for a while, I kind of tease my mom about this because sometimes we'll go shopping and she has experienced many more decades of inflation and what things used to cost. And so she expects things to be much lower in cost because when she was growing up, they were far cheaper, right? So imagine someone that's lived in a house for 30 years and gets asked, well, what would you rent this place out for? I guarantee the amount is going to be way lower than what rent actually costs. It's mm-hmm. it's like you're almost creating like a boomer question.
Yes.
People whose perspective is way cheaper prices for rent from when they actually rented, right? And so I think it's just, it's so manipulated. CPI does not reflect the cost of living or true inflation. And more people need to know that.
That's insane to think about because you're right. The people that own the houses that would rent them are the people that are usually older. I don't see that many young people going out buying houses these days. Even if you finish school and you have a decent job, you're like, okay, I'm going to rent for a while because you can't afford to buy something. And that this environment makes it really hard to do that. So the people that they're asking are the people that have already bought their house many years ago.
Yes.
And they'll probably think literally half of what it should be.
Exactly. You know? And then that, they use that as the rent metric. I mean, it's ludicrous. You want to expect the best intentions, but at some level you start to go, oh, wait, this favors the government so that inflation looks lower. And we just sort of accept it, even though rent has literally gone up like crazy. It goes up way more than the average person's wages in a given year. Yeah. I mean, we got to shine a spotlight on some of these things because they're super, they're just, people need the truth.
And that's what I love, that you're going to highlight stuff like that in your book. I love that you're going to take those ideas that people don't know. That gave me goosebumps. I'm like, oh my gosh, look, I knew that they were just taking out certain data. Look how manipulative, and look how you can find out these truths and you can share it with people. So that's going to be really interesting to see, because how could you not get it? How could you not see that there is so much corruption and that, you know, you can protect yourself from it? You know, that's the main thing. You don't have to be part of that anymore. You can escape it. I mean, it makes me laugh. I want to say it makes me angry, but it just kind of makes me laugh. I'm not even mad about it. Just maybe if I didn't get Bitcoin yet, I'd be a little mad. I don't know. It's just comical at this point. How do they get away with it still? So this is such a crazy problem that people are just okay with. Also, is exciting too, is, are you going to be doing the, like, part of the education for the Nigerian Bitcoin conference?
No, I'm not part of that. No, but I think Ella Huff is a part of that, I think. And there's just a huge, amazing team. I mean, Farida, I don't know if you guys know her story. She was on my podcast. She's also in my book, but just such incredible stories of fighting for sovereignty, individual sovereignty, human rights in Africa. Mm-hmm. I think everyone should pay attention, because Africa has a very young population and a lot of them are embracing Bitcoin, and they're like very active on these digital devices. And there are companies like, I forgot the name of it, Machinkora, I think it's called, where you can actually transact in Bitcoin without an internet connection. So there's just like fascinating things happening in Africa.
Wow, that's so crazy to hear. Like you said, there's just such a movement going on. So many young people that are just getting it. It's a huge market in Africa. And I love that one of the guests I had, Olu, he's the one that's, you know, he's helping organize a lot of this stuff for the conference. And when I spoke to him, he just had this energy about him that just was like, he wasn't worried about money. He wasn't stressed about money. It gives you this energy, this hope, and it was infectious. So thank you so much for joining me today, Natalie. I appreciate your time, first of all. I love everything that you're doing, and I love hearing you speak. Yeah. And I got to meet you in person too in Vegas, which was amazing. You. So I can't wait to get your book. I already have it on pre-order. So
thank you. I appreciate it.
Mm-hmm. And thank you for sharing some of those parts of your book too, that literally gave me chills. Is there anything else you want to talk about that you have coming up?
No, just super excited for the book release. You can pre-order it. I think we're in the process of trying to get a free chapter out so that people can get a little sense of, you know, the style and the contents of the book. So that's my next big goal. And just doing the show, you know, getting great interviews, trying to talk to people and stay on top of all the headlines, because things are developing really, really fast. So always open to feedback and who you guys want on the show that I'll try to get. Thanks for having me on yours. I wish you all the best with your show.
Thank you so much. And yeah, go check out Natalie on Coin Stories if you are not subscribed to her already. Thank you so much, Natalie. Have a great day.
Thanks. You too.